You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We're joined today by Tom Ordeman, Jr., an American risk management specialist and 2013 graduate with distinction of the University of Aberdeen's Master of Science program in Strategic Studies. In addition to having held positions in training and risk management in support of several U.S. government agencies, he spent 16 months forward deployed as an anti-terrorism advisor in Kuwait. He has expert knowledge and joint training experience in counter-IED, irregular guerrilla hybrid warfare, COIN, civil and public affairs, and he is a seasoned OSINT GPS data OS GEOINT fusion practitioner. Say that five times fast. Thank you, Tom, for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, Vince.
So I stopped a little before what you're doing now, a little bit beyond what I said in your bio. You're working in the cybersecurity field now.
That's correct. Basically kind of doing the NIST risk management framework, using that to just kind of evaluate the security status and posture of different information systems.
So you've done real-world counterterrorism and security risk management, meaning people shooting us, blowing us up on the ground, and now you've moved into cyberspace to do some of the same things.
Yeah, kind of. That's probably a good way to put it.
So you're a local, and we talked a couple of weeks ago at an event at the museum, and one of the big reasons I wanted to bring you on Spycast was your expertise on a topic that I know very little about, and that's not easy for me to admit openly. And that's the Dhofar Rebellion, which is often called the secret war because so few people know about it. This, to give you a little background, listeners, it took place between 62 and 76. That's 1962 and 1976, when British and Omani forces fought what began as a localized insurgency, but later would grow and be co-opted and escalated by Cold War tensions, communist guerrillas, bringing in some of the broader Cold War nonsense that was happening in the 60s and 70s. And so this is a very cool topic, very wonky topic for me as a historian. But I think I got to ask the question that I'm sure is on the mind of many of the listeners. Why should we care about a tiny insurgency no one's ever heard about in Oman?
I actually get that question from my fiance all the time. So there's two overarching reasons to care about the Dhofar Rebellion. The first reason is that a lot of the countries that are in the news today were very intimately involved in one sense or another with the conflict. You don't hear a lot about Oman in the news, partly because of the way that the war turned out, but you hear about places like Yemen, which was, you know, very intimately involved in the conflict. You hear about places like Iran. So, for example, one of the concerns about, you know, whether Dhofar was going to go communist or stay within the sphere of the Sultan's influence was that Oman actually, if you really zoom in on Google Maps, you'll see that the south side of the Strait of Hormuz, Oman owns that land. So there, you know, back in the early 70s, the Shah of Iran was still in power. And so there was, you know, this concern of, well, we don't want to lose that side of the Strait of Hormuz to the communists. Well, you know, in subsequent years, we lost the Strait of Hormuz to the regime that's currently in Tehran. So had we lost, you know, both sides, so to speak, and it's not our territory, right, but, you know, lost friendly regimes on both sides, that could have been very problematic. The war set Oman up as a mediator between Iran and the West. So when you see things about the nuclear negotiations between Iran and Western countries, or if you see that an Iranian was released by the West or a Westerner was released by the Iranians, usually Oman is the intermediary in those conflicts. The war set Oman up as a stable country that we don't hear about in terms of, you know, the Arab Spring and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I think, just to interrupt you, I mean, not reading about Oman in the news is usually a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
Right? We're not reading about people in the streets or terrorism happening there or failed states or anything else.
Exactly, which is very, you know, out of character for that region in general. You know, and then you've also got, you look at the status of Yemen, and Yemen is, you know, not in a fantastic situation, and so there was a very real threat that that instability that you saw during the Cold War in Yemen was going to spill over. The second overarching reason is that it's a fantastic case study in counterinsurgency done right, because, you know, you look at the conflicts that we've had in Afghanistan and Iraq that we currently have in, you know, Iraq and Syria, and, you know, other places around the globe, and, you know, there's sort of an ongoing debate whether low-intensity operations are going to continue to be the norm. I'm of the mind that we need to be prepared for both low-intensity operations and, you know, more conventional conflicts. But, you know, really, I think history is showing us that we need to expect that the low-intensity stuff is going to be the norm for the time being. So it really behooves us to kind of look at this case study and other case studies in counterinsurgency done right and say, okay, what lessons can we learn, you know, as far as this goes?
You talk about counterinsurgency done right, and in coin theory, which is counterinsurgency theory, has a pretty poor reputation, mainly because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you argue, you wrote an article for Small Wars Journal, and you argue that's not necessarily a fair assessment. That even taking those two wars into account, we really can't correctly assess the fundamental goodness, for lack of a better term, of coin theory based on those two operations.
Yeah, that's kind of the position that I take, and you know, there's a lot of you know, I won't say it as egos, but there's a lot of skin in the game with a lot of people as far as, you know, answering this question, whether or not coin, you know, can be successful. And what I argue in that particular paper is that you have classical coin theory, which, you know, we can talk in a second about some of the issues with that. And then you have the doctrine that was handed down in 2006, 2007 by the Army and the Marine Corps, which I argue doesn't actually reflect a lot of the great lessons of, you know, classical coin theory and some of those case studies. And then you have what we actually did in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm not necessarily taking pot shots at any of that. I'm just saying, you know, in the paper that there are disconnects between those three things. So I'm not sure that, you know, that's a fair assessment that we actually seriously, you know, tried coin theory. Interestingly enough, somebody picked up that same argument and ran with it on this season of the Serial podcast when they were discussing Bogue Bergdahl and you know, how coin theory influenced that whole situation in Afghanistan.
Well, a lot of people may think coin theory began with David Petraeus and writing a counterinsurgency manual. I mean, this goes back to the 19th century and the colonial period, where the British and others, the British were the preeminent one, but were trying to take insurgencies down throughout their empire. I mean, this is where this real foundation of this theory began.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a totally legitimate criticism, and I don't dispute that at all. And, you know, some of the characters we're talking about are like C.E. Caldwell, and I think it's Robert Trinquier, and, you know, you had these conflicts starting in sort of the late 1800s and going up kind of through the Dhofar Rebellion was the last one that I know of, other than maybe like the Rhodesian conflict in the southern part of Africa during the 70s and 80s. And it's absolutely legitimate criticism that a lot of the theory that came out of those conflicts may not be relevant to today.
So let's push back into the Dhofar Rebellion specifically. And I think you mentioned this earlier and you pointed out that, yes, this is a small little rebellion or insurgency in Oman, but it's really broader too than just a regional fight. There's a lot of foreign involvement. You already mentioned like Iran, but you have on each side the usual suspects of the Cold War lining up behind these two fighting groups. The insurgents themselves is the ADU.
Yeah,
they got clandestine training and logistical and advisory support from the Chinese, the Soviets, Iraq, Libya, the PLO, the Cubans. They train in Peking. They trade in Iraq. And then, of course, on the side of the British and the Omanis, you've got the other usual suspects, everyone from Jordan and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia.
Well, and interestingly, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia started off on the side of the rebels because Saudi Arabia in particular had some disputes with the previous sultan, so there was some friction there. And then eventually, because Iran got involved, you had the Saudis really pressuring Oman to kick the Iranians out and, oh, we'll do all these things for you to help you end the rebellion if you just, you know, get rid of Iran. And
so not only do you have the broad Cold War atmosphere there, but you also have the regional Middle Eastern interstruggles. Yeah. And so I you know, when I started researching this, I had to agree that this is actually a really interesting case study that takes it much broader from the sense of just something really regional in the area. What makes it interesting for us here is that not only were the heavy lifters in the counterinsurgency special operations forces, but also intelligence. So let's start with special operations forces. But really, the main actors when it comes to the fighting of the insurgency from the British a concern is the SAS, is British Special Forces.
See, I would disagree with that. The way I would characterize it is they played a critical role. Interestingly enough, they only ever had, there were a couple of times when they were doing like turnovers where they would have more than one squadron of the SAS in the country. But really their role was very small and very precise and surgical. Their role was to recruit defectors, essentially, from the ranks of the ADU and turn them into sort of a popular militia to fight for the Sultan. They had a five-point plan that included a veterinary program and a medical program and information operations. So they were doing a lot of these things that weren't really fighting. Meanwhile, you had the Sultan's armed forces that were staffed, the officer ranks were staffed primarily by Commonwealth and Anglophone expatriates, either working directly for the Ministry of Defense, you know, on secondment, although there were plenty of guys that were literally contracted by the Sultan directly as mercenaries. So they were doing kind of, you know, I would hesitate to say the heavy lifting because it was a good, combined arms effort. But they were the ones out there occupying positions and patrolling and that kind of thing. But by being able to co-opt the guys from the ADU, the SAS did play this critical role. So not the heavy lifting so much, but a very surgical and very critical part of the campaign.
You talk about information operations. I thought it was very interesting, the idea that this was something they highly emphasized, the idea of leaflets and posters, broadcast radio programs.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, this is Oman, so it's not like there's a radio in every house. So a lot of what they had to do was get the radios out there for the propaganda to work. So it's almost a two-stage, give the people the means to listen to the propaganda and then feed them the propaganda afterwards.
And there were several different, that's a great point. And there were several different things that they did along those lines. Like initially they got these, it was ironic because the Chinese were giving assistance to the rebels and yet the Sultan and his forces were buying these cheap radios from the Chinese. And initially they were giving them out for free. And then they thought, well, we're doing this wrong. We'll heavily subsidize them, but we'll make the locals pay for these radios. And that way, if the ADU come and try to steal the radios away from them, then they're further alienating themselves from the local populace.
Yeah, you wrote that brilliant forethought. Yeah. The idea is, you know, the only repercussions, the only countermeasures that the IDU could possibly have is to destroy or steal these radios.
Yeah.
But if you give the populace kind of a dog in the fight, if you make them give up some of their hard-earned money for this, that will actually alienate them against the rebels. It's a brilliant idea. I mean, can we... Well, this might be a weighted question. Might be one you can't answer. Can we prove forethought there? Or is that one of these happy accidents that they say, yeah, we thought of that all the time?
So the source that I read suggests that there was forethought, particularly because they initially gave them away and then, you know, backtracked and said, well, you know, now that we've gotten a few into the local populace, let's charge for them. So I think there was some forethought there. You know, the programming also should be mentioned, that you had the propaganda broadcast. I mean, we've heard of, like, what was the... In Korea and Vietnam, they had, you know, women speaking English who would come on.
Right,
and,
yeah. I mean, yeah, you've got the... Going all the way back to World War II, Rose and Axis Sally.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
So, you know, you had those kinds of transmissions coming from Radio Aden in what was then the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, otherwise known
South
as...
Yemen, right?
South Yemen, that's right. And probably broadcast from, I think the village is called Hauf, that's just on the Yemeni side of the border down on the Indian Ocean. So you had these very negative broadcasts to try and convince the Dofaris that everything was horrible and that they really needed to, you know, support the insurgency. And so there was this, I think it was Corporal Lane. There was this one SAS corporal who spearheaded this whole thing. And they made sure that it was, I think at that point it was called Radio Dofar, later Radio Salala, and now it's part of just the Omani, you know, Radio Oman, that kind of thing. They ensured that they had very positive, upbeat programming that really focused on efforts by the Sultan's government to make the lives of Dofaris better. One of the things that I cite, and there's a fantastic book by Andrew Higgins called With the SAS and Other Animals. The radio programming included this veterinary medicine program so that, you know, the Dofaris could literally improve their livelihood by taking better care of their livestock, which is a huge part of their economy and their livelihood.
That's an amazing segue. I was going to ask you about, to me, an extraordinary operation. I mean, in the foundation of all this is winning hearts and minds, or keeping hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so it's a lot of things that are pulled from Americans' understanding out of the Green Beret playbook, right?
Absolutely.
You're not necessarily teaching them how to fight right away. You're building latrines. You're doing medicine. Mm-hmm. You're doing all these things. In this operation called Jaguar in 1971, the good guys, as it were, the British and Omani forces, captured hundreds of Adu livestock during this operation.
Yeah.
And they were going to continue to fight, but the Omani forces, actually this was kind of the militia forces, they refused to fight until they could actually make money off this livestock. They
actually had to
sell these livestock at a place that was nowhere near where they were. So the British SAS and had to have essentially a Texas-style cattle drive.
Operation Taurus.
Yeah, to keep these cattle together. I mean, this is, again, these are trained killers. This is the best of the best the British have to offer. And they're cowboying, yee-hawing across the Omani desert to bring these cattle to sale. I mean, this is the kind of above and beyond that's necessary in a counterinsurgency operation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the great things about this campaign relative to, you know, other campaigns that we read about, and again, not casting aspersions on how anybody does anything now, but this is really what unconventional warfare was envisioned as. You get in there, you work with the populace, you build up a militia, and... you know, kind of help them to do their own thing. And then, you know, the kind of direct action raids were left to the conventional forces to do. Very different from the model that we see now where special operations forces are doing primarily these kinetic direct action raids.
It may be unfair to say what we will about cultural misunderstanding in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly in the very beginning. There are a lot of problems, and you can read a whole lot about the issues of just not very high levels of anthropological understanding of the culture there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to jump in and acknowledge the initial campaign plan in Iraq was meant to be short duration. Right. There was an expectation that there was this Iraqi expatriate community that was going to be able to go in and take things over. So I think that's worth pointing out.
But and that's now that why I was hedging a little bit. I was saying, you know, to be fair, it's not necessarily as straightforward as just saying we had no clue.
There was certainly some catch up to be done when things didn't end up going according to plan.
Absolutely. And the segue I wasn't going to make here in this case is that it seemed like the British understood the culture in Oman. I think that's one of the things that really jumps out, that they got it a lot more than perhaps other counterinsurgencies did, where, you know, even some of these posters, these propaganda posters, kind of talked about the hand of God destroying communism and talking about religion as a positive against communism. And again, the cattle drive idea is, you could see potentially a commander today just being like, forget it.
We can't do that. That's not an ROE.
Right. Yeah. That's not in the ROE. Right.
Yeah.
It seems like they understood what was necessary to make this work.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things I would point to as far as that goes is you had a very lengthy period of British engagement. The British and the Omanis had been, you know, had very close relations for a number of years prior to that, really stretching into centuries. And so you'd always had, you know, British military cooperation with the Sultan. There's all sorts of operations that you can read about, particularly the Jebel Akhdar War, which was from basically about 1957 and 1959. And there were a handful of these SAS soldiers who had participated in that conflict who then came back as senior sergeants and senior officers and served in Dhofar again. So you had this long-term engagement by the British military and by the British Foreign Office that really allowed for kind of a retention of institutional knowledge that really, you know, played a big role. Another thing to point out as far as that goes is that most of the personnel that were serving, the Anglophone personnel, and particularly the ones who were seconded from the British military who were on active duty, they received language training, like 10 weeks of language training at, I believe it was Beaconsfield, before they went over. You know, both Ian Gardner, who's a retired Royal Marines brigadier who wrote the book In the Service of the Sultan, you know, he talks about the 10 weeks that they spent doing that language training. Even Andrew Higgins, the veterinarian, got, I think, a couple of weeks, even though his deployment was sort of spur of the moment. So that plays a huge role in these operations, to actually be able to not only communicate with the local populace, but also kind of understand some of the background of their culture.
Let me ask you about the role that intelligence played in the overall operation.
Okay.
We are a spy museum.
We are the spy museum.
Let me break it down. Let's talk about IMINT. Imagery intelligence, this is the 1960s and 70s. This is when the British and the Americans and both sides in the Cold War are starting to use imagery intelligence, whether it's spy planes or satellites, as a predominant intelligence collection platform, especially the West. How big of a role did IMINT play in this operation?
IMINT had some uses, but, you know, a lot of the same things that we tend to run into in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, they ran into there, where an insurgent can hide amongst the populace. They're using, like, literally like caves to hide in. So on the insurgency side, imagery intelligence didn't play a huge role. There was some involvement by English Electric Canberra PR-9 reconnaissance aircraft, which it's kind of, you know, sort of similar to how we outfitted certain models of B-17 during the Second World War as photo reconnaissance aircraft. They had this bomber, the English Electric Canberra, that they produced an actual model that was a photo reconnaissance, PR-9, model of the aircraft. And so what they primarily used that for was photo reconnaissance over South Yemen, to kind of trying to figure out what the Yemeni military was doing as far as supporting the rebels. And then there was some other strategic intelligence that they did with those as far as the Saudis and the Emiratis and some of the other stuff that was going on elsewhere in the region. But as far as the, you know, the actual insurgency, it played a really kind of a really minimal role.
And I imagine SIGINT falls into somewhat the same idea. These are not technologically advanced insurgents. They're not running around with encrypted radios. They're
not exactly.
necessarily, you know, the higher tech really may not work as well here because there just isn't anything to collect.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. They, we know for a fact, and you know, it's worth pointing out here, and we'll probably get into this shortly, that there was a high degree of operational security on the British side. So there's a lot of these records that have not made it out really into the public sphere yet. Some of them are available at the National Archives in London. But as far as, you know, easily digestible resources, they're few and far between. We do have available online the medal citations for some of the SAS troops who served in a particular battle that I suspect we'll probably mention at least at some point, called the Battle of Murbat. But in these medal citations, it talks about intercepted radio transmissions. But prior to a certain point, I want to say it was 71 or 72, most of the ADU didn't have radios, so there really wasn't anything to pick up. My presumption is that as the war went on, there was more saturation of listening devices on the part of the Sultan's armed forces, but you know, probably still fairly limited to pretty low-level tactical chatter as opposed to really valuable intelligence.
Right. So it really pulls it all down to Hewmint as the primary source of intelligence here. And you know, and it's very difficult to do any kind of coin campaign, especially if you're focusing on the population and conventional operations. And you'd already talked about this idea that defectors mm-hmm. were one of the key resources, key collection resources for the British and the Omanis.
And really doubly so. They played a dual role because obviously they knew what they had been up to when they were serving with the ADU. So they could come over and say, well, this operation's being planned, or, you know, this is where this particular leader, or this particular, you know, band of guerrillas is located. But then the SAS in their campaign, their, you know, Operation Storm, their piece of the whole picture, they really took it a step further because those ADU came over and defected. They were recruited into what were called the FERCAT, which is, that's the plural form, and an individual group of these militia was the FERCA. But these FERCAT militias would then help with the capture of a particular piece of real estate. It would be secured. They bring in a prefabricated, essentially a prefabricated village, a mosque, a clinic, a school, you know, three or four different buildings right there. And then they drill a well. That was huge because of the cattle and because, you know, during large parts of the year, the area of Dhofar is very dry. And then as people came to use these resources, pray at the mosques, send their kids to school, then these defected FERCAT folks would be used to collect intelligence from the local populace. So not only were they bringing their own information, but they were then able to get information from the locals, which was hugely effective.
None of this means anything unless you can keep your own secrets. And I think that one of the primary success stories from this operation is the British counterintelligence. And I think that, and not just the British, the Allied counterintelligence on the Omani side as well. You're really, because you're competing from the populace, you can't stop doing counterintelligence. I mean, this is a constant. This is another situation because it's a quasi-civil war where you don't necessarily have uniforms on the battlefield.
Right.
You don't know who the good guy is and the bad guy is. And this is one of the last times, I would argue, certainly, because Vietnam changes all of this with television and everything else, one of the last times you have a major war where you can have this level of secrecy that you would never be able to do today. I mean, there's no press, there's no television, there's no radio, or they didn't allow press into the country while they were fighting it. And really a security blackout. This is probably as good as it gets when it comes to operational security.
If there's any criticism of this campaign as far as lessons for modern campaigns, this is that criticism, because General Tony Jeeps, who was he's retired now as you know, SAS, I think he was a major general, but he was, you know, a colonel leading the SAS detachment at one point of this conflict, having served previously in the conflict. He lays it straight out and says, we had a level of secrecy in that war that would probably be impossible today. They literally, I can't remember what my source is on this. This may have been a Dofar veteran that I spoke with myself. But there's this story about a Russian photojournalist who landed in Salala, which is the capital of Dofar. It's kind of where all of this was centered. And got off the plane, started taking a few pictures, was immediately rolled up. All of his equipment confiscated and destroyed, and he was put on the first plane back to Muscat and deported. You know, it's hard to imagine that happening right to, you know, somebody for the AP who lands in Kabul and, you know, has a camera.
Well, and that, well, we're embedding journalists now, so it's even more than absolutely. That. Yeah, you know. Well, I'm wondering about the Furkat, which you talked about. What was the fear potentially about double agents? People pretending to defect, people who are gathering information, or just bad OPSEC on their point. They're not necessarily going to be particularly good at maintaining secrets. I mean, was there a fear of having people who pretended to defect or just bad security overall?
Absolutely. This actually went back to the Jebel Akhtar War about a decade and a half earlier, where they literally, as they were getting ready to assault the mountain, gave false information to a group of goat herders so that they would go and pass this on and feed bad information to the enemy. So there were accusations and suspicions that weapons that went missing had been handed over to the ADU by potential defectors, and certainly there was a fear that they were either inadvertently or possibly deliberately passing information onto the bad guys. So the British did, you know, a number of different things. I think the most interesting is some of the deception operations that they did, which involved, in some cases, you know, just planting information. They would, you know, have chatter saying, oh yeah, this big operation's going to start and we're doing this and we're going to assault this target. And then the target was actually somewhere else on a completely different day. There were several operations that were staged entirely as deceptions to draw the ADU to a particular area, and then the actual objective was assaulted.
Well, you referenced a battle a little bit earlier, and I think it's kind of central to this. So why don't you walk us through that a little bit?
So that would be the Battle of Murbat. So Murbat is this little, I'm assuming it's a fishing village. I don't know if it's within sight of Salalah, but it's kind of on the same little stretch of coastline. And you had the SAS didn't operate as, hey, we're the Special Air Service. They were the British Army Training Team. That was the acronym. That was the euphemism. Right. So they operated as the BAT out of the BAT house in Murbat.
An unbelievable opportunity to me, the Bat Cave.
Absolutely, because there are caves.
There's caves everywhere. So the Bat House.
So yeah, the Bat House, and there were 9 SAS troops there. There was a local garrison just across the village, and the reports, you know, are different as far as how many ADU attacked. But the idea on the part of the ADU was, we are going to come, and I'll just clarify at this point, ADU is Arabic for enemy. So if anybody was curious how'd they get that name, their actual names were the Popular Front for the Liberation of Oman and the Arabian Gulf. And then later they shortened that to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Oman. But it was shortened to ADU, which is Arabic for enemy. So the ADU idea was, we will stage this massive attack, like this Tet offensive style attack on this garrison in Murbat. We'll take Murbat, and basically it's game over at this point. So with only a little bit of assistance from that local garrison, these 9 SAS soldiers were able to fend off this attacking force of, like, I think the minimum is 200 ADU foot soldiers. Who were coming through and had mortars, and it was this massive attack against these 9 guys. There was one point where, you know, several of these guys ran over to these old artillery pieces and were literally firing them, like, not even indirect fire, just firing them directly at the bad guys as they were coming. And eventually they received air support in the form of Strike Master aircraft that were attacking the Addu. And the Addu happened to time this attack for when they were preparing the turnover with a different SAS squadron. So another squadron came to their defense and were able to fight them off. But it was, people are fond of claiming that this was like this massive turning point in the war. And really the war was won by, you know, the SAS and the Furcot doing their piece, and then the more conventional forces doing all of this patrolling and actual kinetic attacks against Addu positions. But Murbat was a really important piece of it. The Addu really never recovered their bravado after that.
Well, and how much impact did it have on the hearts and minds of the Omani people, seeing that these nine British guys were willing to fight off hundreds of the Addu for their cause?
Absolutely. You know, just, it's tough to quantify the impact of that, but it's also tough to downplay it.
Right.
I mean, that's really a huge victory for them. Not only the fact that they were willing to, you know, essentially fight for their lives, but for this cause instead of running away, but also that, you know, these guys proved so much more formidable than this force that was supposedly trying to take over this entire governorate.
Yeah, if you're picking a side, you go with the nine guys
that
just beat the living bejesus out of the 200 guys. Those are the ones that you want to be on their team.
Absolutely.
And at what point does this war peter out? And does it peter out because they kill all the Addu? How do they end up, Iraq, Afghanistan, Vietnam, we fought them, we won every battle, we lose the war. Sounds like we're winning every battle here. How does the war end? How do you finally get the Addu, how do the British and the Omani, it's your fault. How do you finally get...
I was born years after this thing took place, but...
How do they finally get the Addu to quit?
You know, it really, that's a fantastic question, and it goes to the heart of it. It really was a hearts and minds campaign, because it wasn't all about killing the bad guys. It was about convincing both the bad guys and the local population, hey, you're going to be better off with us. Let's all come together. And so, you know, that's one of the things that Ian Gardner says in his book, is that really the Addu won too, because they wanted change. They were very, very disaffected by the previous Sultan's rule. And you know, that's an element worth pointing out, that the Dhofar Rebellion really heated up right when there was a change of administration in Oman. And so you had this new young Sultan that came in. He had bona fides as a Dhofari because his mother was from Dhofar. He, you know, wasn't guilty of all the excesses that his... excesses might be the wrong word to use, but the disputes that they had with his father, the prior Sultan, those weren't laid on his shoulders. And so he had this very brief opportunity to really change the game. And with the help of the British, he did. And that was the campaign, was we are doing all of the civil development because we know it's overdue and we have the resources now to do it with the discovery of oil. Come help us, come be a part of the solution. And, you know, I don't know that translates directly to what we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I think certainly for future conflicts and potentially even for, you know, continuing conflicts that we're in, that's a good object lesson in how to build consensus. And that's really what won the war.
Well, Tom Ordeman is a risk management specialist working both in kinetic operations and now in cyber operations. You can read several of his articles in Small Wars Journal. That's a really cool online site that kind of dives into these issues much deeper than we can here today. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thanks so much for having me, Vince. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter @INTLSpycast. That's INTL Spycast. Talk to you next week.